We should start with reviewing for the exam. So, a couple of blanket statements. One, if I mention it in class, it's on the exam. If I didn't mention it in class, it's not on the exam. So, in other words, the reagent that I mentioned in lab earlier, POCl3, dehydrating agent, we hadn't discussed it in lecture yet, so it won't be on the exam. Formal charge and oxidation state, technically a lecture topic, could technically therefore be on the exam. Although I had hinted that more likely that specific topic may show up on a lab exam. But, so if we talked about a lecture, it's testable material. Now, what about this list of Chem 12A reactions that I'd sent around? How much of that do you really need to know? Well, I'm not going to be asking specifically mechanism questions from reactions from last quarter. Now, I would really hope that you remember simple things like SN1 and SN2. And we've already seen, I think our quiz problem had an SN2 little bit of mechanism in it. Yes? Say that again. So many people keep asking, and now that I'm telling you, people are still asking. So, for the Chem 12A material, you need to know it for synthesis. You don't need to know it for mechanism. Of course, you've got to remember last quarter's material, because how could you survive this quarter if you didn't? And one of the ways that the course was taught that was different than past years is we didn't do a lot of multi-step synthesis last quarter, because we spent an awful lot of time on fundamentals. Since we didn't do that multi-step synthesis last quarter, you are doing it this quarter, which means you need to know those reactions from before. Now, that's part of the reason why I've been trying to give some of these sample problems. And hopefully from the sample problems, you've noticed, for example, just how many times alcohols have been an intermediate in things. So out of anything else that you need to know from last quarter, you should know how to make an alcohol in different ways, which the main ways we learned were hydroboration oxidation, oxymercuration demercuration, and then hydrolysis. Not the only reactions that you should be worried about. Now I'll turn it around this way. If this is supposed to be the continuation of 12A, would I ever tell you, no, don't worry about 12A reactions? Also think that if I'm teaching you new material, how much time can I really spend asking about last quarter's material? So you've got to know 12A. You've got that list of reactions. You've had the hint there's certain ones that I care about more than others. And you've been told don't worry about mechanism for those reactions. Anything else I'm not going to comment on. Because at some point, you're learning chemistry and you just got to know the chemistry. Those are my general statements. Now, I'm going to go through a specific list of topics, though, of things I think are most important for this quarter's material. If I've left something out, don't be afraid at this point to ask. But if I happen to forget something, it's just because it's not coming to my forethought. This doesn't mean this is the exclusive list. But these are the things I'm thinking about, which gives you, again, a hint of the types of things I may ask for problems. So, again, focusing on alcohols first. You've learned how to turn them into chlorides, bromides, iodides, and sulfonates. You've also learned dehydration. Again, using acid and heat. We have not yet done the POCl3. We've learned oxidation. In fact, there's several subsets to that. We've done selective oxidation of primary alcohols. And we've done overoxidation. Uh, of primary alcohols. Related to that is this protonate open attack, the protonate mechanism, because the whole reason why primary alcohols overoxidize is because they can make hydrates. That's if you are in an aqueous environment. Now we do, of course, have oxidation of secondary alcohols, and remember, tertiary alcohols can't be oxidized. Last reaction I would throw under with alcohols would be the Williamson ether synthesis. Which, along with that, means you need to know how to make alkoxides. Now, we haven't done much with aldehydes and ketones. For the most part, they're not on this exam. The one thing we did do is the reduction of aldehydes and ketones. And along with that, you should know the difference in reactivity. Not specifically what they react with, but just the fact they are different in reactivity. You need to know the difference between lithium aluminum hydride and sodium borohydride, which, if you don't remember, it has to do with electronegativity differences. Boron is less electronegative than hydrogen. Aluminum is below boron on the periodic table, which means it's even less electronegative than hydrogen. So hydrogen acts more like an ion in lithium aluminum hydride than it does in sodium borohydride, which is partly the reason for the difference in reactivity between the two compounds. The only other thing with aldehydes and ketones we did, besides nomenclature, is the formation of a hydrate, that protonate open attack deprotonate sequence. We also had epoxides. And we saw different ways of making them, so their formation. And we talk about how to open them under cationic and anionic conditions. We did, backing up a little bit, we did talk about the reactivity of aldehydes versus ketones. You might remember the one smog diagram that I can recall during this quarter was related to this difference in the reactivity. A couple of random things. We have the pinnacle rearrangement, which was just an example of some of the strange things that can happen with carbocations sometimes. And then again, I'll yet again hint that this might just show up on a lab quiz instead. But something that is technically a lecture topic is formal charge versus oxidation state. As far as the types of problems that you're going to have, you might have nomenclature again of exactly the same type that we've done already, having a mix of aldehydes, ketones, alcohols, the type of functional groups we've been worried about so far this quarter. You will absolutely have fill in the blank and mechanism. There'll be some form of synthesis problem. Maybe not even anywhere as difficult as what we've done so far. Partly the examples I've shown you are to lay the groundwork for future practice for exam 2 and 3, where we really have a lot of reactions in our hand to do more complicated synthesis. But some synthesis of some form will be on this exam. And then we haven't done a heck of a lot with theory, although I did just mention aldehydes versus ketones. There is an explanation for why aldehydes are more reactive than ketones. And that would be the type of thing I could get at some kind of theory problem. So, this section, I believe you've already seen the answers to all of the in-class synthesis problems we did last week, including the formation of that epoxide with the right stereochemistry. We talked about CrO3 the variation of mechanism for using that as a reagent. So I think we've caught up with everything else that sections 1 and 2 have done as far as test material. So are there any questions then? Over any of this material, because hopefully you did study over the weekend, and I was just curious if we do have questions. Yeah? Finkelstein would be the way that we learned how to make iodide, so it would include it, yes. Yeah?
The example definitely finishable now, right?
I didn't claim that. What I will say is that if somehow the exam isn't finishable in an hour, then we'll do what we've done before, which is to use the succeeding lab time to finish. I prefer not doing exams that way, so that would just mean that you would have to have the weekend to study, wouldn't it? But don't count on it, I'll say, either, because I may make this a streamlined enough exam that you'd be expected to finish. Other questions? No more questions about any of these reactions? If I pass the exam out now, you'd be ready for it? No more questions, you just need to do more studying. Then, let me clearly show you this line. To show you that everything after this is not part of exam one. But since we got all this time left today, we got to really start working on info for exam two. So, our topic today is supposed to be cationic and anionic reactions of carbonyl compounds. And we've actually seen an example of each of those already. We had the POD mechanism, which we'll see again today, for turning an aldehyde or a ketone into a hydrate. Exactly the same mechanism we're going to use with joining an alcohol to an aldehyde or a ketone. And we're going to end up with a series of functional groups that are known as hemiacetals, hemiketals, acetals, and ketals. So that'll be our example of cationic reactions that we move on with. Then we have anionic reactions, the most important of which we'll get today is the Grignard reaction, which some of you might have heard that term before. If you hadn't, it's one of the most important carbon-carbon bond-forming reactions we're going to learn throughout the whole course. So let's start with cationic first. And we're going to start with these. Hemiacetals, hemiketals, acetals, and ketals. So I'll start with an aldehyde first. And before I get there, let me just make a comment on these different terms. I'm going to show you first the formation of a hemiacetal and an acetal. That A that's in there for hemiacetal or acetal is related to aldehyde. You might guess then that hemiketals and ketals are related to ketones. Some texts actually combine these various terms now, and I believe it's the ketal term that wins out. But you'll still see enough people using these older terms with acetals in them that I myself will continue to use these terms. And one place this may show up, I say may because it's been a long time now. I used to do part of the tutoring for, I think it was the Princeton Review. I forget which company now, it's been enough years. But back when I was a grad student, I did some prep work for the MCAT. And one question I remember seeing a lot in the practice exams was to identify these functional groups. So I'm going to show you their synthesis, I'll show you how to identify them, and then later in the quarter, we'll talk about their synthetic use. The reason we learn these at all, in some senses, is because sugars naturally form these different functional groups, hemiacetals, ketals, and full acetals and ketals. So let's start with the aldehyde first. This is a cationic mechanism, and so you'd have an alcohol plus some kind of acid source, a source of H plus in solution. So I'll just choose ethanol, nice common alcohol. So the first step would be
protonate. This is a fully reversible reaction, so this is one of those reactions in which I'm really going to use fully reversible arrows. And I know that I just indicated this PODE mechanisms on your exam, so I don't want to confuse you at this point. But realize that the open step at this point is nothing more than resonance. And two resonance structures really aren't in some sense. The true molecule is somewhere between those two structures. So I'm going to show you a variation that's often used where you can condense down the reaction mechanism a little bit, save a little bit of writing time. Because if you recognize that that opening of the carbonyl is just resonance, then to some extent it doesn't matter whether you show that opening separately, as we did in the past, or whether you show it occurring simultaneously with the incoming attack of, in this case, an alcohol. So this is the open and attack steps combined. So we'll have a deprotonation occur after that. And we end up with this intermediate that looks kind of like a hydrate. Except notice that it's got one OH group on it, but it's also got one OR group on it. So since it's half and half, that's why it's referred to as a hemiacetal. Heavy part again comes from the fact that it's got half and half these different functionalities. And the acetyl comes from the fact that it came from an aldehyde. So you've got a hydrogen that's there on that common carbon between the two oxygens. Well, these hemiacetals normally are not isolatable. They tend to either fall apart back to the aldehyde they came from, or it further reacts to make a full acetal. Where it further reacts is another cycle of protonate, open, attack, deprotonate. So OH group gets protonated. You make water, which can then leave. After it leaves, you still have alcohol in solution. So you have attack of another alcohol. And a deprotonation. And this is a full acetal. So questions about this mechanism, forming the acetal. So, instead of just showing the reverse reaction, I'm going to switch to a different example. So I'm going to write that, in fact, in the notes. I know the last time I did this, some of you missed that I was doing something like that, that I changed example molecules. And you got confused later on when you were studying and said, well, how did he get from that place to this place? There is no connection between what I just showed you and the next thing, other than the fact that the mechanism, the reverse mechanism for what I'm about to show you, is identical to the reverse mechanism for this. I just want to show it to you with a different set of example molecules. So, let me put that disclaimer in. So this next example has nothing to do with where we just came from. Again, other than the fact the reverse mechanism happens the same way. Because the example molecule I'd like to use is a full ketal. The way that we know that's a ketal is that there's no hydrogen at that carbon that's common to the two oxygens. So that same central place, which is kind of like a disguised carbonyl. In fact, that's a concept we'll come back to in just a moment. This is effectively a way of hiding the fact that you've got a carbonyl there, temporarily. So there's no hydrogen there. That's how we know it's not an acetal. The way we know it's a full ketal is we have two OR groups attached and no alcohol attached. If we had the alcohol, then it would be a hemiketal. So, how does this mechanism work in reverse? It's still rounds of protonate open attack deprotonate. So the first thing that happens is one of the two oxygens gets protonated. Since both of those oxygens will eventually come off the carbon, it doesn't matter which one we start with. So we get protonation. Then something's going to open up. Now, you could imagine a couple of different possibilities. This central oxygen is the thing that's positively charged. So technically, the top part of the molecule here could disconnect. You could break that carbon-oxygen bond. But if you did so, you'd make a primary carbocation. That's not all that favorable. If instead this lower carbon-oxygen bond broke, the one that's connected to a carbon that's connected to another oxygen, if you broke that bond, you're going to form a carbocation right next door to an oxygen with a lone pair. And because of that, that lone pair helps stabilize the carbocation. And so even if it were primary, which in this case it's not, but even if it were, it'd be a lot more stable than normal. So the ring's going to open this way. And I'll just put a note to the side here that the carbocation is stabilized by the neighboring lone pair. To help make this reaction happen, to force it back to the aldehyde or the ketone, you're going to have water around as a reagent. And if you looked at the forward mechanism, water is removed at some point. And so in the reverse, water comes back. And then we'll have a deprotonation, which will get us to the hemiketal. And again, it's hemi because you have half of it being OH functionality, half of it being an ether functionality. And it's again a ketal because there's no hydrogen at that common carbon. Now this is just halfway there though. You're going to have the other round of protonate open attack the protonate. But you might look at this and say, wow, we got three different oxygens. Which one of them is going to get protonate? Oh yes, before I move on. Pull it down, sure. Okay, so I was saying there were three different oxygens. Which one's going to get protonated? Well, the answer is yes, because they're all three oxygens. They all three, at some point or another, might get protonated. But only the protonation of one of them is actually going to get us in the forward direction. How do we know that one's going to happen? Well, it has to happen eventually. All of them will get protonated at some point. In one case, if this OH group that just got put on got protonated, we'd be going back towards the ketal. If this OH that's at the end of the chain here gets protonated, it's unlikely much is going to happen since it would just form a primary carbocation even if it came off. But if the ether oxygen gets protonated, then something else can happen. Carbon-oxygen bond can open. Which again is made more favorable by the fact that we have a carbocation that forms with a lone pair next to it. And to show that stabilization, I'll show that lone pair attacking and closing up to make the carbonyl, which the last step there is just deprotonation. So, one more time, it's a different set of molecules than the forward direction that I showed you. But every step of that acetal formation is identical to every step in the ketal formation. It's just a difference in words, which is really just a difference in a hydrogen between an acetal and a ketal. Now, a comment about this product, because I could talk about how making the ketone from the ketal is an equilibrium process where you're having to add water in. But you might remember from me talking the other day about equilibrium where I said that if an equilibrium can occur, it will occur. Well, then you might look at this and say, wait a minute. Water was needed to get to this point. That means water is still around. A ketone can react with water to make a hydrate. And so since equilibrium happens, that means this is going to make a hydrate. And yes, it is. But a hydrate's not normally a thermodynamically stable product. And so even though in solution you might get the hydrate, in actuality, if you try to remove your solvent, isolate the product, you're only going to get the ketone. So although technically, because water is still present, a hydrate will form, since it's not thermodynamically stable, it won't actually be isolated. So one more time to summarize. We have hemiacetals, which form from an aldehyde by adding one molecule of an alcohol to it. Effectively adding a second molecule of an alcohol makes it into a full acetal. Exactly the same mechanism. If we take a ketone and add a molecule of alcohol, that gets a hemiketal. Add two molecules of water, that gets a full ketal. How are these used synthetically? I'll show you in just a moment. But before we move on, questions about the mechanism? Yes. Say that one more time. It doesn't happen just in the ether, but it's the only useful reaction that moves us forward. So in real life, all three oxygens are going to keep getting protonated. And if the bottom right oxygen gets protonated, you're going to go back towards the ketone. If the top oxygen gets protonated, nothing useful is likely to happen. And if and when the left-hand oxygen gets protonated, then the reaction is going to continue on. Yeah.
So this ketone could theoretically be in a small protein.
So this ketone could, in what
sort of product that we want, could potentially be in small quantities because there's other possibilities?
No. Over time, with water, you're going to drive it towards the ketone. If you think of the Chatelier's principle, you keep adding more and more water, and water is not directly a reagent at this point, but you could also try to drive off the alcohol, and that would encourage you to go all the way to the ketone. Other questions on this mechanism? Well, this is a cationic reaction. I want to show you that Grignard reaction. That's the really important anionic reaction. And after the exam, we'll get some more detail about how bits of this reaction work. But this is going to be the first time you see the use of an organometallic reagent. So the way that a Grignard reaction generally starts is you have an alkyl iodide, usually a chloride or bromide, that you react with magnesium metal, along with diethyl ether or THF. Now, does anybody remember the structure of THF from last quarter? You remember that some people are saying yes. More of you are saying, well, I remember there being something called THF last quarter. Sounds familiar. So that's good enough. So here's the molecule furan, which I'm giving you because after all of this carbonyl chemistry we're doing, we'll be coming back to aromatic molecules, which this one counts as an aromatic molecule. This is furan. If you add four hydrogens to it, which just like brackets for O can be a general term to represent oxidation, brackets around H is sometimes used as a general term for reduction, or more specifically, hydrogenation. So add four hydrogens, that's where the tetrahydro comes from. So this is tetrahydrofuran. Very common lab solvent. Why is ether THF used in this case? Because the reagent that's going to be formed can only form due to complexation between the oxygen and magnesium. So if you don't have the ether, the THF reaction won't be successful. What you end up with is, a general term is organometallic reagent. which means it's got carbon, but it's got a metal incorporated into the structure as well. More specifically, these are generally referred to as Grignard reagents. This is not the only example, not even just in terms of carbons. There's other metals that can get involved sometimes. But this is one of the most common ones and the one we're going to start with for today. Now, later, again, after the exam, I'll show you the mechanism for the formation of this, as well as the more advanced mechanism of how a Grignard reacts. But essentially, the Grignard acts as if it is a carbanion. And it therefore will attack a carbonyl center. So if I had a ketone, for example, and I used one of these Grignard reagents, because the carbonyl gets attacked, gets pushed open, you'll end up with an alcohol. Most importantly, we end up with a new carbon-carbon bond. So a general term often used, and we've seen this term before actually, is alkylation, when we're adding an alkyl group to something. Now, Grignard reagents, because they act like carbanions, are really basic reagents. And so that's why we end up with an alkoxide first, because you push open the carbonyl, there's no acid around for anything else to happen. So later on, though, as a second step, you add H+, the alkoxide gets neutralized, and you end up with the product alcohol. Now, we'll do lots more examples, but since you've had these two examples of a carbonyl reaction, a cationic and anionic, I want to show you some of the synthetic use of ketals and acetals, anticipating a lecture we're going to have later on the quarter around something known as protecting groups. So I want you to consider the following factoid. That another way to introduce deuterium, in some cases into organic compounds, another way to do it is to use a Grignard reagent. Because if we took something like isopropyl bromide, react it with magnesium in ether, we make a Grignard reagent. That because it acts like a base, if you throw water at it, water is a relative acid. If you throw D2O at it, heavy water, you can add a deuterium to something. So this is an advantageous reaction, but normally this would be considered a bad thing. Normally, if we want to do a reaction with a Grignard reagent, we want to throw it at a carbonyl-containing compound. So here's the situation. Let's say that I had this combination ketone alcohol. And what I'd like to do is to be able to add an alkyl group to the carbonyl. But I have an alcohol there. So if I threw a Grignard reagent at this, then the only thing that would happen at first is to deprotonate. And more generally, Grignard reagents are destroyed by oxygen, carbon dioxide, water, or protic molecules. Anything that's even a little bit acidic because of how basic these Grignard reagents are. So what could we do if we wanted to do a reaction where we did something so that the alcohol doesn't react? We can use what's called a protecting group, which we haven't, I haven't shown you a protecting group for an alcohol yet. So even though I've done this big lead up here, what I'm really trying to show you is that there's such thing as incompatible chemical reactions. Because what if instead of doing, instead of this example, to shift gears just slightly, what if I wanted to make a Grignard reagent out of this molecule? Won't work. Because if you did get it to form, it would instantly react with itself. So in the first example, the alcohol is a problem because the Grignard reagent is going to attack it. In the second example, the Grignard reagent, if you formed it, would attack itself. But what if we did this? What if we took the carbonyl and added an alcohol to it? This specific alcohol has the systematic name of ethane 1,2-diol. Also has the common name, ethylene glycol, or antifreeze. Why is this used? Because it makes that cyclic acetal or ketal. I didn't show you the acetal, I showed you a ketal earlier. But it rapidly forms a five-membered ring, protects or masks the fact that you have a carbonyl. But you still have the bromide, which could still now do a reaction. Grignard reactions are basic reactions. Acetals and ketals form and decompose in acid. So if we're doing a bunch of basic reactions, this ketal that we just made won't do anything. So I could react it with magnesium to form a Grignard reagent. Again, let me highlight that this is base stable. So if I then added some other molecule, like let's say I just wanted to make the chain one step larger. It's a type of reaction known as homologation. A homolog is something that's the same but just a little different size. Homologation means to make a new molecule that's very similar but usually just one carbon bigger. Well, this Grignard reagent would attack. And then later on, when you're working up the alkoxide, you have a little water around as well, that at the same time that the alcohol forms from that alkoxide, you'll decompose the protecting group. So up here, when we made the ketal, that was a protection step. You're masking the carbonyl. At the end, we deprotect. We get rid of that masked functionality. There's entire systems of protecting and deprotecting conditions and reagents. Because in advanced synthesis, you might have four or five different types of protecting groups on a molecule that you pop on and off at will, selectively at just the right points in different syntheses, so you can make really complicated connections between molecules. So, I first showed you a cationic carbonyl reaction, I then showed you an anionic carbonyl reaction, and then I've showed you a taste of synthesis problems to come when we're using protecting groups. Questions over anything that we've covered for today? Now you look at me with those just end it now kind of looks. I'll just remind you that everything we just covered is not on exam one. So if you're looking at this in fear, realize you've got several more weeks to overcome your fear before you have to give an exam over this. So questions?